From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Out of the Sea by A.C. Benson. It was about 10 o'clock on a November morning in the little village of Bleay-on-the-Sands. The hamlet was made up of some 30 houses which clustered together on a low rising ground. The place was very poor, but some old merchant of bygone days had built in a pious mood a large church, which was now too great for the needs of the place. The nave had been unroofed in a heavy gale, and there was no money to repair it, so that it had fallen to decay, and the tower was joined to the choir by roofless walls. This was a sore trial to the old priest, Father Thomas, who had grown gray there, but he had no art in gathering money, which he asked for in a shamefaced way, and the vicarage was a poor one, hardly enough for the old man's needs, so the church lay desolate. The village stood on what must have been an island, the little river Reddy, which runs down to the sea, there forking into two channels on the landward side. Towards the sea the ground was bare, full of sandhills covered with a short grass. Towards the land was a small wood of gnarled trees, the boughs of which were all brushed smooth by the gales. Looking landward was the green flat in which the river ran, rising into low hills. Hardly a house was visible save one or two lonely farms. Two or three church towers rose above the hills at a long distance away. Indeed, Bleay was much cut off from the world. There was a bridge over the stream on the west side, but over the other channel was no bridge, so that to fare eastward it was requisite to go in a boat. To seaward there were wide sands when the tide was out. When it was in, it came up nearly to the end of the village street. The people were mostly fishermen, but there were a few farmers and laborers. The boats of the fishermen lay to the east side of the village, near the river channel, which gave some draught of water, and the channel was marked out by big black stakes and posts that straggled out over the sands like awkward leaning figures to the sea's brim. Father Thomas lived in a small and ancient brick house near the church with a little garden attached. He was a kindly man, much worn by age and weather, with a wise heart, and he loved the quiet life with a small flock. This morning he had come out of his house to look abroad, before he settled down to writing his sermon. He looked out to sea, and saw, with a shadow of sadness, the black outline of a wreck that had come ashore a week before, and over which the white waves were now breaking. The wind blew steadily from the northeast, and had a bitter, poisonous chill in it, which it doubtless drew from the fields of the upper ice. The day was dark and overhung, not with cloud, but with a kind of dreary vapor that shut out the sun. Father Thomas shuddered at the wind and drew his patched cloak round him. As he did so, he saw three figures come up to the vicarage gate. It was not a common thing for him to have visitors in the morning, and he saw with surprise that they were old Master John Grimston, the richest man in the place, half farmer and half fisherman, a dark, surly old man, his wife Bridget, a timid and frightened woman, who found life with her harsh husband a difficult business, in spite of their wealth, which for a place like Bleay was great, and their son Henry, a silly, shambling man of 40, who was his father's butt. The three walked silently and heavily as though they came on a sad errand. Father Thomas went briskly down to meet them, and greeted them with his accustomed cheerfulness. "And what may I do for you?" he said. Old Master Grimston made a sort of gesture with his head, as though his wife should speak, and she said in a low and somewhat husky voice the rapid utterance. "There is a matter, Father, we would ask you about. Are you at leisure?" Father Thomas said, "Aye, I am ashamed to be not more busy. Let us go in the house." And they did so, and even a little distance to the door, the father thought that his visitors behaved very strangely. They peered round from left to right, and once or twice Master Grimston looked sharply behind them, as though they were followed. They said nothing but aye and no to the father's talk, and bore themselves like people with a terrible fear. Father Thomas made up his mind that it was some question of money, for nothing else was wont to move Master Grimston's mind. So he led them into his parlor and gave them seats, and then there was a silence, while the two men continued to look furtively about them, and the wife sat with her eyes upon the priest's face. Father Thomas knew not what to make of this, till Master Grimston said harshly, "Come, wife, tell the tale, and make an end. We must not take up the father's time." "I hardly know how to say it, father," said Bridget, "but a strange and evil thing has befallen us. There is something come to our house, and we know not what it is, but it brings fear with it." A sudden paleness came over her face, and she stopped, and the three exchanged a glance in which terror was visibly written. Master Grimston looked over his shoulder swiftly, and made as though to speak, yet only swallowed in his throat. But Henry said suddenly in a loud and woeful voice, "It is an evil beast out of the sea." And then there followed a dreadful silence, while Father Thomas felt a sudden dread leap up in his heart at the contagion of fear that he saw written on the faces round him. But he said with all the cheerfulness he could muster, "Come, friends, let us not begin to talk of sea beasts. We must have the whole tale. Mistress Grimston, I must hear the story. Be content, nothing can touch us here." The three seemed to draw faint comfort from his words, and Bridget began. "It was the day of the wreck, father. John was up early before the dawn. He walked out to the sands, and Henry with him, and they were the first to see the wreck. Was not that it?" At these words, the father and son seemed to exchange a very swift and secret look, and both grew pale. "John told me there was a wreck ashore, and they were presently and roused the rest of the village, and all that day they were out, saving what could be saved. Two sailors were found, both dead and pitifully battered by the sea, and they were buried, as you know, father, in the churchyard next day. John came back about dusk, and Henry with him, and we sat down to our supper. John was telling me about the wreck, as we sat beside the fire, when Henry, who was sitting apart, rose up and cried out suddenly, 'What is that?'" She paused for a moment, and Henry, who sat with face blanched, staring at his mother, said, "Aye, I did. It ran past me suddenly." "Yes, but what was it?" said Father Thomas, trying to smile. "A dog or cat, perhaps?" "It was a beast," said Henry slowly in a trembling voice. "A beast about the size of a goat. I never saw the like, yet I did not see her clear, but I felt the air blow and caught a whiff of it. It was like salt, like the sea, but with a kind of dead smell behind." "Was that all you saw?" said Father Thomas. "Perhaps you were tired and faint, and the air swam around you suddenly. I have known the like myself when weary." "Nay, nay," said Henry, "this was not like that. It was a beast, sure enough." "Aye, and we have seen it since," said Bridget. "At least I have not seen it clearly yet, but I have smelt its odor, and it turns me sick. But John and Henry have seen it often. Sometimes it lies and seems to sleep, but then it watches us. And then again it is merry and will leap in a corner." And John saw it skip upon the sands near the wreck. "Did you not, John?" At these words the two men again exchanged a glance, and then old Master Grimston, with a dreadful look on his face, in which great anger seemed to strive with fear, said, "Nay, silly woman, it was not near the wreck, it was out to the east." "It matters little," said Father Thomas. "Who saw well enough this was no light matter? I never heard the like of it. I will myself come down to your house with a holy book, and see if the thing will meet me. I know not what this is," he went on, "whether it is a vain terror that hath hold of you, But there are spirits of evil in the world, and the sea, too doubtless, hath its monsters. And it may be that one has wandered out of the waves, like a dog strayed from his home. I dare not say till I have met it face to face, but God gives no power to such things to hurt those who have a fair conscience. And here he stopped and looked at the three. Bridget sat regarding him with hope in her face, but the other two sat looking at the ground, and the priest divined in some secret way that all was not well with them. "But I will come at once," he said, rising, "and I will see if I can cast out or bind the thing, whatever it be. For I am in this place as a soldier of the Lord to fight with the works of darkness." He took a clasped book from a table and lifted up his head, saying, "Let us set forth." Then he said as they left the room, "Hath it appeared today?" "Yes, indeed," said Henry, "and it was ill-content. It followed us as though it were angered." "Come," said Father Thomas, turning upon him, "you speak thus of a thing as you might speak of a dog. What is it like?" "Nay," said Henry, "I know not. I can never see it clearly. It is like a speck in the eye. It is never there when you look upon it. It glides away very secretly. It is most like a goat, I think. It seems to be horned and hairy, but I have seen its eyes, and they were yellow like a flame." As he said these words, Master Grimston went in haste to the door and pulled it open as though to breathe the air. The others followed him and went out, but Master Grimston drew the priest aside and said like a man in mortal fear, "Look you, Father, all this is true. The thing is a devil, and why it abides with us I know not, but I cannot live so, and unless it be cast out, it will slay me. But if money be of avail, I have it in abundance." "Nay," said Father Thomas, "let there be no talk of money. Perchance, if I can aid you, you may give of your gratitude to God." Aye, said the old man hurriedly, "that was what I meant. There is money in abundance for God, if he will but set me free." So they walked very sadly together through the street. There were few folks about. The men and the children were all abroad. A woman or two came to the house door and wondered a little to see them pass so solemnly, as though they followed a body to the grave. Master Grimston's house was the largest in the place. It had a walled garden before it, with a strong door set in the wall. The house stood back from the road, a dark front of brick with gables. Behind it the garden sloped nearly to the sands, with wooden barns and warehouses. Master Grimston unlocked the door, and then it seemed that his terror overcame him, for he would have the priest enter first. Father Thomas, with a certain apprehension of which he was ashamed, walked quickly in and looked about. The herbage of the garden had mostly died down in the winter, and a tangle of sodden stalks lay over the beds. A flagged path edged with box led up to the house, which seemed to stare at them from its dark windows with a sort of steady gaze. Master Grimston fastened the door behind them, and they went all together, keeping close to each other, up to the house, the door which opened upon a big parlor or kitchen, sparsely furnished, but very clean and comfortable. Some vessels of metal glittered on a rack. There were chairs ranged round the open fireplace. There was no sound except the wind which buffeted in the chimney. It looked a quiet and homely place, and Father Thomas grew ashamed of his fears. "Now," said he in his firm voice, "though I am your guest here, I will appoint what shall be done. We will sit here together and talk as cheerfully as we may till we have dined. Then, if nothing appears to us," and he crossed himself, "I will go round the house into every room and see if we can track the thing to its lair. I will abide with you till evensong, and then I will soon return and sleep here tonight. Even if the thing be wary and dares not to meet the power of the church in the daytime, perhaps it will venture out at night, and I am prepared to face it. So come, good people, and be comforted." So they sat together, and Father Thomas talked of many things, and told some old legends of saints, and they dined, though without much cheer, and still nothing appeared. Then after dinner, Father Thomas decided to view the house. So he took his Bible, and they went from room to room. On the ground floor there were several chambers not used, which they entered in turn, but saw nothing. On the upper floor there was a large room where Master Grimston and his wife slept, and a further room for Henry, and a guest chamber in which the priest was to sleep, and a room where a servant maid slept. And now the day began to darken and to turn to evening, and Father Thomas felt a shadow grow in his mind. There came into his head a verse of scripture about a spirit who found the house empty, swept, and garnished, and called his fellows to enter in. At the end of the passage was a locked door, and Father Thomas said, "This is the last room. Let us enter." "Nay, there is no need to do that," said Master Grimston in a kind of haste. "It leads nowhere. It is but a storeroom." "It would be a pity to leave it unvisited," said the father, and as he said the word there came a kind of stirring from within. "A rout, doubtless," said the father, striving with a sudden sense of fear. But the pale faces round him told another tale. "Come, Master Grimston, let us be done with this," said Father Thomas decisively. "The hour of vespers draws nigh." So Master Grimston slowly drew out a key and unlocked the door, and Father Thomas marched in. It was a simple place enough. There were shelves on which various household matters lay, boxes and jars with twine and cordage. On the ground stood chests. There were some clothes hanging on pegs, and in a corner was a heap of garments piled up. On one of the chests stood a box of rough deal, and from the corner of it dripped water, which lay in a little pool on the floor. Master Grimston went hurriedly to the box and pushed it further to the wall. As he did so, a kind of sound came from Henry's lips. Father Thomas turned and looked at him. He stood pale and strengthless, his eyes fixed on the corner. At the same moment, something dark and shapeless seemed to slip past the group, and there came to the nostrils of Father Thomas a strange sharp smell as of the sea, only there was a taint within it, like the smell of corruption. They all turned and looked at Father Thomas together, as though seeking comfort from his presence. He, hardly knowing what he did, and in the grasp of a terrible fear, fumbled with his book, and opening it read the first words that his eyes fell upon, which was the place where the blessed Lord, beset with enemies, said that if he did but pray to his Father, he should send him forthwith legions of angels to encompass him. And the verse seemed to the priest so like a message sent instantly from heaven that he was not a little comforted. But the thing, whatever the reason was, appeared to them no more at that time. Yet the thought of it lay very heavy on Father Thomas's heart. In truth, he had not in the bottom of his mind believed that he would see it, but had trusted in his honest life and his sacred calling to protect him. He could hardly speak for some minutes. Moreover, the horror of the thing was very great, and seeing him so grave, their terrors were increased, though there was a kind of miserable joy in their minds that someone, and he a man of high repute, should suffer with them. Then Father Thomas, after a pause, they were now in the parlor, said, speaking very slowly, that they were under a sore affliction of Satan, and that they must withstand it with a good courage. "And look you," he added, turning with a great sternness to the three, "if there be any mortal sin upon your hearts, see that you confess it and be shriven speedily, for while such a thing lies upon the heart, so long hath Satan power to hurt, otherwise have no fear at all." Then Father Thomas slipped out to the garden, and hearing the bell pulled for vespers, he went to the church, and the three would go with him, because they would not be left alone. So they went together. By this time the street was fuller, and the servant maid had told tales, so that there was much talk in the place about what was going on. None spoke with them as they went, but at every corner people could be seen talking, and as the father approached, a silence would fall upon a group, so that they knew that their terrors were on every tongue. There was but a handful of worshippers in the church, which was dark, save for the light on Father Thomas's book. He read the holy service swiftly and courageously, but his face was very pale and grave in the light of the candle. When the vespers were over, and he had put off his robe, he said that he would go back to his house and gather what he needed for the night, and that they should wait for him at the churchyard gate. So he strode off to his vicarage, but as he shut the door, he saw a dark figure come running up the garden. He waited with a fear in his mind, but in a moment he saw that it was Henry, who came up breathless, and said that he must speak with the father alone. Father Thomas knew that some dark secret was to be told him, so he led Henry into the parlor and seated himself and said, "Now, my son, speak boldly. There was an instant silence, and Henry slipped onto his knees. Then in a moment Henry, with a sob, began to tell his tale. He said that on the day of the wreck his father had roused him very early in the dawn, and had told him to put on his clothes and come silently, for he thought there was a wreck ashore. His father carried a spade in his hand, he knew not then why. They went down to the tide, which was moving up very fast, and had left but an inch or two of water on the sands. There was a little light, but when they had walked a little, they saw the black hull of a ship before them, on the edge of the deeper water, the waves driving over it, and then all at once they came upon the body of a man lying on his face on the sand. There was no sign of life in him, but he clasped a bag in his hand that was heavy, and the pocket of his coat was bulging, and there lay moreover some glittering things about him that seemed to be coins. They lifted the body up, and his father stripped the coat from the man, and then bade Henry dig a hole in the sand, which he presently did, though the sand and water oozed fast into it. Then his father, who had been stooping down, gathering something up from the sand, raised the body up and laid it in the hole, and bade Henry cover it, and so he did till it was nearly hidden. Then came a horrible thing. The sand in the hole began to move and stir, and presently a hand was put out with clutching fingers, and Henry dropped the spade and said, "There is life in him!" But his father seized the spade and shoveled the sand into the hole with a kind of silent fury, and trampled it over and smoothed it down, and then he gathered up the coat and the bag and handed Henry the spade. By this time the town was astir. They saw very faintly a man run along the shore eastward, so making a long circuit to the west. They returned. His father had put the spade away and taken the coat upstairs, and then he went out with Henry and told all he could find that there was a wreck ashore. The priest heard the story with a fierce shame and anger, and turning to Henry said, "But why did you not resist your father and save the poor sailor?" "I dared not," said Henry, shuddering, "though I would have done so if I could. But my father has a power over me, and I am used to obeying him." Then said the priest, "This is a dark matter, but you have told the story bravely, and now I will shrive you, my son." So he gave him shrift. Then he said to Henry, "And have you seen aught that would connect the beast that visits you with this thing?" "Aye, that I have," said Henry, "for I watched it with my father's skip and leap in the water over the place where the man lies buried." Then the priest said, "Your father must tell him the tale too, and he must make submission to the law." "He will not," said Henry. "Then will I compel him?" said the priest. "Not out of my mouth," said Henry, "or he will slay me too." And then the priest saw that he was in an awkward position, for he could not use the words of confession of one man to convict another of his sin. So he gathered his things in haste and walked back to the church. But Henry went another way, saying, "I made excuse to come away, and said I went elsewhere, but I fear my father much. He sees very deep, and I would not have him suspect me of having made confession." Then the father met the other two at the church gate, and they went down to the house in silence, the father pondering heavily, and at the door Henry joined them, and it seemed to the father that old Master Grimston regarded him not. So they entered the house in silence, and ate in silence, listening earnestly for any sound. And the father looked oft on Master Grimston, who ate and drank, and said nothing, never raising his eyes. But once the father saw him laugh secretly to himself, so that the blood ran cold in the father's veins. He could hardly contain himself from accusing him. Then the father read prayers, and prayed earnestly against evil, and that they should open their hearts to God, if he would show them why this misery came upon them. Then they went to bed, and Henry asked that he might sleep in the priest's room, which he willingly granted. And so the house was dark, and they made as though they would sleep, but the father could not sleep, and he heard Henry weeping silently to himself like a little child. But at last the father slept, how long he knew not, and suddenly woke from his sleep with a horror of darkness all around him, and he knew that there was some evil thing abroad. He looked down upon the room. He heard Henry mutter heavily in his sleep, as though there was a dark terror upon him, and then in the light of the dying embers, the father saw a thing rise upon the hearth, as though it had slept there, and woken to stretch itself. And then in the half-light it seemed softly to gambol and play. But whereas when an innocent beast does this, it seems a fond and pretty sight, the father thought he had never seen so ugly a sight as the beast gambling all by itself, as if it could not contain its own dreadful joy. It looked viler and more wicked every moment. Then, too, there spread in the room the sharp scent of the sea, with the foul smell underneath it, that gave the father a deadly sickness. He tried to pray, but no words would come, and he felt indeed that the evil was too strong for him. Presently the beast desisted from its play and looked wickedly about it, came near to the father's bed, and seemed to put up its hairy forelegs upon it. He could see its narrow and obscene eyes, which burned with a dull yellow light, and were fixed upon him. And now the priest thought that his end was near, for he could stir neither hand nor foot, and the sweat ran down his brow. But he made a mighty effort in a voice which shocked himself, so dry and husky, and withal so loud and screaming a tone it was. He said three holy words. The beast gave a great quiver of rage, but it dropped down on the floor, and in a moment was gone. Then Henry woke, and raising himself on his arm, said something. But there broke out in the house a great outcry and the stamping of feet, which seemed very fearful in the silence of the night. The priest leapt out of his bed, all dizzy, and made a light, and ran to the door and went out, crying whatever words came to his head. The door of Master Grimson's room was open, and a strange and strangling sound came forth. The father made his way in and found Master Grimston lying upon the floor, his wife bending over him. He lay still, breathing pitifully, and every now and then a shudder ran through him. In the room there seemed a strange and shadowy tumult going on, but the father saw that no time could be lost, and kneeling down beside Master Grimston, he prayed with all his might. Presently Master Grimston ceased to struggle and lay still, like a man who had come out of a sore conflict. Then he opened his eyes, and the father stopped his prayers, and looking very hard at him, said, "My son, the time is very short. Confess your sins." Then Master Grimson, rolling his haggard eyes upon the group, twice strove to speak and could not, but the third time the father, bending down his head, heard him say in a thin voice that seemed to float from a long way off, "I slew him, my sin." Then the father swiftly gave him shrift, and as he said the last word, Master Grimson's head fell over on the side, and the father said, "He is gone." And Bridget broke out into a terrible cry, and fell upon Henry's neck, who had entered unseen. Then the father bade Henry lead her away, and put the poor body on the bed. As he did so, he noticed that the face of the dead man was strangely bruised and battered, as though it had been stamped upon by the cloven hoofs of some beast. Then Father Thomas knelt, and prayed until the light came filtering in through the shutters, and the cocks crowed in the village, and presently it was day. But that night the father learned strange secrets, and something of the dark purpose of God was revealed to him. In the morning there came one to find the priest, and told him that another body had been thrown up on the shore, which was strangely smeared with sand, as though it had been rolled over and over in it, and the father took order for its burial. Then the priest had a long talk with Bridget and Henry. He found them sitting together, and she held her son's hand and smoothed his hair, as though he had been a little child, and Henry sobbed and wept, but Bridget was very calm. "He hath told me all," she said, "and we have decided that he shall do whatever you bid him. Must he be given to justice?" And she looked at the priest very pitifully. "Nay, nay," said the priest, "I hold not Henry to account for the death of the man. It was his father's sin, who hath made heavy atonement. The secret shall be buried in our hearts." Then Bridget told him how she had waked suddenly out of her sleep and heard her husband cry out, and that then followed a dreadful kind of struggling with the scent of the sea over all, and that he had all at once fallen to the ground, and she had gone to him, and that then the priest had come. Then Father Thomas said with tears that God had shown them deep things and visited them very strangely. Then lastly he went with Henry to the storeroom, and there in the box that had dripped with water lay the coat of the dead man full of money, and the bag of money, too, and Henry would have cast it back into the sea. But the priest said that this might not be, but it should be bestowed plentifully upon shipwrecked mariners, unless the heir should be found. But the ship appeared to be a foreign ship, and no search ever revealed whence the money had come. Master Grimson was found to have left much wealth, but Bridget sold the house and the land, and it mostly went to rebuild the church. Then Bridget and Henry moved to the vicarage and served Father Thomas faithfully, and they guarded their secret. Now the beast troubled those of whom I write no more, but it is easier to raise up evil than to lay it, and it is said to this day that a man or a woman with an evil thought in their hearts may see on a certain evening in November, at the ebb of the tide, a goat-like thing wade in the water, snuffing at the sand as though it sought, but found not. The Closer of the Way by Robert Bloch. To this day, I don't know how they got me to the asylum. The events leading up to my committal constitute a mystery which defies the probe of memory, and so it shall remain. Family and friends spoke at the time of a nervous condition, but that is undoubtedly a polite euphemism. They preferred to call the asylum a private sanatorium, and my incarceration was referred to as convalescence. But now that I have no family and no friends, I can at least speak freely and frankly of my situation. I was insane. God, what hypocrites we've become! The higher the incidence of insanity in our society, the more the word itself has been tabooed. In a world gone mad, it is no longer possible to speak freely of madmen. In this era of lunacy, there are supposedly no lunatics. The craziness compounds because we refuse to admit that anyone is crazy. Mentally ill, that's the phrase which Dr. Connors used. Paranoid schizophrenia was another and more highly clinical description, neither which really conveys an accurate impression of the horror inherent in the reality or the unreality. Insanity is a long nightmare from which some never awaken. Others, like myself, eventually open their eyes to greet the dawn of a new day, rejoicing in renewed awareness. It is a wonderful feeling to realize that the nightmare has ended. Makes you want to sing as I did. Yes, we have no bananas. Dr. Connors eyed me dispassionately. What's that supposed to mean? He said. That I'm all right again, I smiled. Bananas, the current slang for insanity. It's a kind of a joke. I see. But Dr. Connors didn't really see anything. When I assured him that I was no longer disoriented, no longer hostile or afraid, he merely nodded. And when I told him I was ready to go home, he shook his head. There are some problems we must work through first, he said. Work? That's my only problem, I told him. I've got to get back to work. Do you realize what staying here has cost me? Dr. Connor shrugged. Your work is one of the problems we're going to be talking about. I think it may help us to find the cause of your difficulties. He opened a desk drawer and took out a book. I've been reading some of the things you've written, and there are a number of questions. Okay, I said. If you want to play games, suppose you let me have the first guess. The book you have there, the one you've been reading, it's Psycho, isn't it? Yes. Don't look so surprised. Everybody seems to start out by reading Psycho and reading things into it. I've been through this sort of inquisition so many times that you don't even need to ask the questions. We can both save valuable time if I just give you the answers. I'm listening. First of all, I don't hate my mother, and she never dominated me. My family background was perfectly normal. I had no hang-ups as far as my parents or my sister are concerned. My mother was a social worker and teacher, a very intelligent woman who encouraged me to write. I love her dearly, but there was no Oedipal fixation involved. Secondly, I've never been conscious of any homosexual tendencies, never felt the desire to experiment in transvestism, or taxidermy, for that matter. I know nothing about motel operation or hiding cars and bodies in swamps. So you can see I'm not Norman Bates. And as for identifying with other characters in the book, I never embezzled any money from any employer, ran away, never conducted a long-term clandestine liaison. For that matter, I've always preferred a tub bath instead of a shower. I smiled at Dr. Connors. The idea for the book came to me after reading about an actual murder case. I didn't use any of the real-life participants as characters, nor the real-life situation. What set me off was wondering how a man living in a small town all his life, under constant scrutiny of his neighbors, could manage to conceal his crimes of violence. What I did, call it the case entry if you will, was to construct a psychological profile of such a man, just as you do in your work. Once I felt I understood the character and his motivations, the rest was simple. Dr. Connors nodded. Thank you for your cooperation. You've anticipated and answered all of my questions except one. And that is? Let me put it this way. I imagine you read up on quite a few murder cases as a matter of course. It would be the natural thing to do in your line of work.
That's true.
And some of them are pretty sensational, aren't they? Mass murders, bizarre slayings and ritual killings,
weird deaths occurring under strange circumstances.
Also true. Some of them, I'm sure, are far more shocking and violent than the particular crime which, in your words, set you off.
Right.
Then my question is simply this. Why did this one murder intrigue you? Why did you choose it rather than another?
But I've already explained. It was wondering how the killer managed to conceal his activities and get away with it. How he was able to avoid suspicion, lead a double life.
That's interesting. The problem of concealment, avoiding suspicion. Dr. Connors leaned forward. Do you lead a double life?
I stared at him for a long moment before answering.
Forgive me for saying so, but you're out of your mind.
Perhaps, but being out of my mind doesn't matter. It's getting into your mind that's important.
He stood up. That's enough for now, I think. We'll talk again tomorrow.
More questions?
Hopefully more answers. He gave a little chuckle. It appears I'm going to have to do some further reading tonight.
Well, good luck to you, and pleasant dreams.
That's the title of one of your books, isn't it?
Pleasant Dreams?
I've written a lot of books, I said, and a lot of stories.
I know.
He walked me to the office door. Oh, one final thought. Did it ever occur to you that all fiction writing is a form of lying, and that the only major difference between an author and a psychotic is that the former puts down his fantasies on paper? You might think that over.
I will, I told him.
And I did. All that day and during the night which followed, in the end, I arrived at one firm conclusion. I disliked Dr. Connors intensely.
It was late in the afternoon next day before Miss Frobisher came to my room and said that Dr. Connors was ready to see me. The long wait hadn't been easy on the nerves, and I'm sure she noticed how uptight I was. Miss Frobisher was a good nurse, I suppose, and treating patients like naughty children was just a part of her job. The fact that she was a little on the butch side probably contributed to her kindly authoritarianism, but I found her manner irritating.
And how are we today? She greeted me. Are we ready for our therapy session?
Speaking for myself, I've no objection, I said, but I happen to be alone. If you insist on addressing me in the plural, perhaps you need therapy more than I do.
Miss Frobisher laughed professionally.
Never show anger, never let them get to you. That's the secret. And guided me down the hall.
Doctor's waiting for you in the surgery, she said.
Don't tell me I'm going to have a prefrontal lobotomy, I murmured. This I need like a hole in the head.
Miss Frobisher laughed again.
Nothing of the sort. But the painters are doing his office and won't be finished until sometime tomorrow. So, if you don't mind...
Fine with me.
She led me into the elevator, and we got off on the third floor. I'd never been up there before, and was a little surprised to discover that Dr. Connors had a very efficient and compact medical unit installed. I knew, of course, that he was a neurosurgeon as well as a practicing psychiatrist, but I found myself quite impressed by the completely equipped modern surgery, which I glimpsed beyond the wall glass of the outer room where Dr. Connors waited for me. I smiled at him as Miss Frobisher left. "We've got to stop meeting this way," I said. "Sit down." One look convinced me he wasn't in the mood for fun and games. I seated myself and faced him across a small table on which rested a notepad and a book. "Uh-huh," I murmured, glancing at the book. "So you did read Pleasant Dreams?" "All last evening." "I see you made some notes," I told him. "Since when did you become a critic?" "I'm not here to criticize, only to discuss." "Go ahead. We writers like to hear people talk about our work." "I was hoping you might do the talking." "What's to say? It's all in the book."
"Is it?"
"Look," I said, "is it really necessary to talk like a shrink?"
"Not if you're willing to stop talking like a patient." Dr. Connor smiled and glanced at the notepad.
"But I am a patient," I said, "according to you."
"According to Pleasant Dreams, you're quite a number of things. For instance, a collaborator of Edgar Allan Poe's."
"The Lighthouse," I nodded.
"A postcaller, back east. Found the unfinished story and suggested that I complete it."
"Do you frequently get plots or ideas from other people?"
"None that I can use. Most of my stuff comes from my own background or interest. I wrote The Dream Makers because I was always a silent movie fan, and Mr. Steinway represents a similar preoccupation with music. I like to use locales I visited or lived in. Milwaukee in The Cheaters, New Orleans in The Sleeping Beauty, upstate Wisconsin in Sweet 16, that hellbound train, and Hungarian Rhapsody." I grinned at Dr. Connors. "But that's the bottom line. I've never owned a pair of magic eyeglasses, slept with a skeleton, ridden a motorcycle, made a bargain with the devil, or had an affair with a vampire."
Granted, Dr. Connors squinted at his notes. "So far we've talked about things you like. Now, let's get on to what you dislike."
"That's easy," I told him. "Formal dinner parties inspired the proper spirit, and I suppose the Hungry House represents an aversion to mirrors. In fact, if you really want to probe, it means I've always been self-consciously displeased with my own looks. Is that candid enough for you, Doc?"
"Not quite," he stared at me.
"Why don't you want to discuss the real problems?"
"Such as?"
"Your attitude towards children."
"I've got nothing against children."
"That's not what your stories say." He tapped the notepad with his pen. "In Sweets to the Sweet, a little girl is a witch. The Sorcerer's Apprentice deals with a mentally retarded youth whose delusions lead to murder. Catnip is a thoroughly vindictive portrait of adolescence. Sweet 16 is an indictment of an entire generation. You were writing about Satanist motorcycle gangs almost a decade before others picked up the notion for films. Even in a comparatively gentle story like The Hellbound Train, your protagonist starts life as a runaway, a drifter who steals hubcaps and gets stoned on canned heat. And in Enoch, your central character is a psychotic teenager who becomes a mass murderer.
"Kids aren't my hang-up," I said. "Don't forget, I write horror stories. And in a youth-oriented society, people are more apt to be shocked by having children depicted as monsters. The trick lies in violating the taboos we hold sacred. That's what I did to the mother image in Psycho."
"Trick," said Dr. Connor softly. "Lies."
I grinned again. "So, now we're playing word games, right? In that case, let's just call it a Freudian slip." He shrugged. "That reminds me of another element in your work, not just in this collection, but in literally dozens of your stories, the hostility towards psychiatrists."
"I don't hate psychiatrists."
"Your characters seem to. There are disparaging references to psychotherapists in The Sorcerer's Apprentice, I Kiss Your Shadow, and other titles in the book. And in Enoch, your Dr. Silversmith is a caricature, a gross libel of the profession."
"But that's just another way of shocking people," I said. "Psychiatrists have become the high priests in a society that worships science. Showing them as incompetent or powerless to prevail against the forces of evil is an effective gimmick."
Dr. Connor stared at me.
effective gimmicks. That's what you look for. Meaning things that induce fear in the reader. Your entire career has been spent in finding ways to shock people, horrify them. It's a living, which you yourself chose. Nobody spends a lifetime frightening those he loves. Why do you hate people? I don't. Think about it. Think about it seriously. I intend to, he glanced at his watch. Until tomorrow, then. Sorry if it sounds like I'm stonewalling, I said, but I really don't hate people. Which was true. I didn't hate my readers or kids or shrinks per se, but I was beginning to hate Dr. Connors. It was a bad night. I didn't get any sleep because I was too busy planning my own defense. Perhaps that sounds a trifle melodramatic, but there really was no other word for it. I had to defend myself when Dr. Connors attacked me by using my own words. My own words. It was unfair, unjust, unspeakable. Only an idiot would equate make-believe with reality. Actors who played villains weren't monsters in real life. Boris Karloff and Christopher Lee were two of the nicest persons I've ever known. My own literary mentor, H.P. Lovecraft, was a kind and gentle man. If Dr. Connors thought otherwise, he was only displaying his own ignorance or his own cleverness. He was searching for something, something which escaped me, something connected with my own condition, no doubt, something blocked and obscured by an amnesiac reaction. If I could only recall what happened. But that wasn't important now. The important thing was to be prepared for tomorrow's attack. Attack through my own books. Which title would he select? I tried to anticipate his choice in my own mind. American Gothic, Night World, Firebug, The Deadbeat, The Kidnapper, The Will to Kill, The Scarf, all were possible selections. But all these novels possessed a common theme, the ease with which a psychopath could operate with our supposedly sane society. Surely, such a premise is legitimate, subject for examination. And if Dr. Connors planned to play devil's advocate and ask why I was so preoccupied with psychopaths, I'd tell him the truth. I'm afraid of them, Doctor. Aren't we all? That was it. Just tell the truth. The truth shall make you free. I had plenty of time to consider the matter because Miss Frobisher didn't come for me until after dinner the following evening. Dr. Connors, she said, had been called away on personal business during the afternoon, but he'd returned now and was waiting for me again in the anteroom to the surgery unit. Sorry about that, he told me as Miss Frobisher departed. The painters finished my office, but I haven't had time to get things straightened out yet. So if you don't mind, not at all. Dr. Connors was seated at the table, notepad resting on top of a book. I glanced at the book as he spoke, trying to see the title. Which one had he chosen? There was no need to play guessing games. He was already lifting the pad, exposing the volume underneath. It was the opener of the way. He nodded at me. As you can see, I've done my homework. You expected that, didn't you? Yes, but not your choice. Why this instead of a novel? Because it's your first book, your first published story collection, and because of the title. If you read it, you know that the opener of the way is one of the stories. But that's not why you selected that title, is it? You were making a statement of intention. This book was opening the way to your writing career. Very perceptive. What else did you notice? That certain constant elements in your work go back almost to the beginning. Mass murders, for example, in Waxworks. House of the Hatchet. Yours truly, Jack the Ripper. The invasion or desecration of the human body. Beetles. The Dark Demon. The Shambler from the Stars, the Fiddler's Fee, and the opener itself. Plus the theme of possession by evil forces or an alter ego in the cloak, the mannequin, the dark demon, the eyes of the mummy. You must admit it all seems to add up. To what? To the recurrent image of a man possessed by a demon, mutilating his victims in a series of multiple murders. I shrugged. As I told you, it's a living. And as you told me, all fiction is a form of lying. These particular lies happen to be the ones I live by. They worked for me when I started writing, and they still work for me today.
But you don't lie all the time, do you?
Dr. Connors opened the book.
What about the introduction you wrote for this collection?
You start out by asking the very same question I've been asking you. Where do you get the ideas for your stories?
I've already told you that.
Dr. Connors flipped a page.
You give a different answer here. You say that a fantasy author is cast in the dual role of Jekyll and Hyde.
Just a figure of speech.
Is it?
He glanced down at the text. Let me read your own words. Dr. Jekyll attempts to deny the very existence of Mr. Hyde. But Mr. Hyde exists. I know, for he is a part of me. He has been my literary mentor now for more than a decade. And now, the last paragraph of your introduction. And when anyone inquires as to where I get the ideas for my stories, I can only shrug and answer, from my collaborator, Mr. Hyde.
That's an exact quote.
I stared at him. Yesterday I told myself that I was beginning to hate this man. Today,
something wrong?
Only with your conclusions.
Not mine, yours.
Cut the double talk. Are you saying I'm a multiple personality?
You're saying it in your introduction here, and in your work.
That's double talk with a vengeance.
I'm not interested in vengeance, I shook my head,
and I don't hate people.
So says Dr. Jekyll, but Mr. Hyde tells a different story, over and over and over again.
It's just a story.
Are you sure? Dr. Connor shook his head.
Then why are you here?
I don't know.
Don't know or don't remember?
Both.
Exactly. In multiple personality disorders, there's always this element of amnesia, of disassociation. My job is to help you recall. I was hoping that analyzing your work would lead you to find clues to reality. Once you face the truth...
What is the truth?
There are many truths.
Consider them.
You're in a private sanatorium, and you wouldn't be here unless there was a reason. You're under tight security, and that should suggest the reason is a serious one. You can't remember what happened prior to your arrival. Surely this implies a personality split protected by an amnesic reaction.
I took a deep breath.
What you're saying is that I flipped out and killed somebody?
No, Dr. Connor smiled.
Consider the facts. If you'd killed somebody, you'd be downtown, at the county jail.
But I did flip, didn't I?
Yes, he smiled again. Before we continue, perhaps I'd better remind you of another truth. I'm here because I'm interested in your welfare. I'm not your enemy.
Locking me up? Playing cat and mouse games with me? Prying into my stories, my secrets? And expecting me to believe he wasn't my enemy? Maybe I was crazy, but I wasn't stupid.
Of course not, I returned his smile. Shall we get on with it?
Dr. Connors consulted his notepad.
There's another thread weaving itself through your fiction. Not just the fantasies, but the mystery suspense stories. I've read so many of them deal with variations on a single numit.
What's that?
Decapitation.
Is that so unusual?
It's a common enough device for shocking the reader. Even the Queen and Alice in Wonderland kept saying,
let's stick to your own work and what you say
about the collector of heads and man with a hobby and the collector of skulls and the skull of the Marquis de Sade and the other collector called Enoch. What motivated you to write The Cure, The Headhunter, or See How They Run? There's a head lopped off in Psycho, and the final scene in The Night World speaks for itself. Heads roll in The Hound of Pedro and that old college try.
Dr. Connors picked up the book.
You did it here in Waxworks, and your very first published book, The Feast in the Abbey.
And a dab good thing, I said.
That's what made an impression on the readers, not just the idea of cannibalism, but when the narrator finds out what he's been eating, when he lifts the lid of the small silver platter and sees the head of his brother.
Quite effective, I agree. Dr. Connors looked up at me.
I notice you wrote in the first person.
That's part of the impact.
And where did the idea come from? A newspaper story, something you heard or read about?
I don't remember. After all, that was so long ago.
Odd, isn't it, that this should be one of your earliest efforts, And that you continued the same theme over the years? He kept staring at me. You've told me the source of so many of your stories. Surely there's a point of origin for this one and those which follow the pattern. I told you I can't remember. Nothing in your personal background? I am not a cannibal, if that's what you're hinting. I do have a younger sister, but no brother, so I could hardly cut off his head. It was hard to speak quietly because I hated him so, and it was hard to hear him now because of the way my heart was pounding, pounding, pounding. Look, said Dr. Connors, I'm going to tell you something that will help you to remember. It may shock you, but sometimes shock therapy is the most effective method. Go ahead, I said. A head. Head? It was the head of my brother. Dr. Connors was watching my face, but I'm positive he couldn't hear the voice inside my head. My head. His head. Their heads? I forced myself to look at him, forced myself to smile. Don't tell me I cut off somebody's head, I said. No, but you tried. That's a lie. I stood up and I wasn't smiling now. That's a lie. You mean you can't remember, but you did, and they stopped you just in time. It's all there in the record. But why? Why? Because the person you attempted to kill apparently reminded you of someone else. Someone long ago. Dr. Connors leaned forward, speaking very softly, so that I had to strain to hear him. I did hear him, though. I must have, because the hate kept building, building as he spoke. Only I still can't recall what he said. It was about something that happened when I was very young, something I did to someone, and Mama found out about it, and the doctor came, and then they sent me away for a long time, and when I came home again, I forgot all about everything. I was just a kid. I didn't know. I didn't mean it. I hated him, but I forgot. Nobody ever talked about it. Nobody ever even knew about it. Except now, Dr. Connors knew. He'd gone away today and looked up the information. Now he was telling me about it, and he'd tell everybody, and I hated him because I still couldn't remember. But I do remember what I did when he told me. It was all luck, really. Being in that room next to the surgery, and then later finding the backstairs exit and getting over the wall. It was even luck that there was one of those silver things with a lid on top, right next to the nurse cabinet in the surgery. I keep thinking of that now, thinking of how Miss Frobisher must have come back, and what she saw when she lifted up the lid. It was the head of my psychiatrist.